happiness spelled like this. Say, Changchub. Louder. Changchub. Semke. Changchub. Semke. Alright. Changchub stands for Bodhi, and it means enlightenment. Okay. Sem means mind, and that's a translation of Chitta in Sanskrit. And Ke means to develop that state of mind. Okay. So developing the state of mind that wants to reach enlightenment. Okay. I'm going to talk about it tonight in a very special sense. And to understand the way I'm going to talk about it, you have to know something that's called the five paths. Okay. Path in Buddhist philosophy is a synonym for Ngontok or Tokpa, which means a realization. So say Lam, Nga. Lam, Nga. Okay. So they're not really paths in the sense of a way to get to Buddhahood or something like that. They are paths in the sense of they are levels of spiritual development. There are five levels of spiritual development that every person goes through before they reach Buddhahood. Okay. And eventually every living creature will go through these five paths. Okay. Some of you may be on path five, some of you may be on three. I have no idea who's who, okay? If you're all like really Shanti Devas, you're just pretending to come here and but sooner or later you have to go through the five paths. So I'm gonna do a real quick thing about the five paths, and then we're gonna talk about the wish. I call this, by the way, the wish for enlightenment, the bodhicitta. Okay, we'll go through the five paths. Say, Soglam? Soglam? Okay, Soglam is the path of accumulation. It's very, very hard to get to Soglam. It takes a long time to get to Soglam. It takes a long time to get to path number one. Even after you decide to do it, it takes a long time. I won't say how long, because then you'll quit. Anyway, you can do it in this life. And that is when you reach real renunciation. It's very useful if someone close to you dies. Okay? There was a great Tibetan Lama, Gampopa, and his wife died. And he started to feel, he was at the time a layman. He became a monk later, I think. And anyway, he got real renunciation. And he met the wife's uncle, and he was saying how lucky it was that his wife had died, because he started to get real renunciation. And the uncle threw dirt in his face, you know. but real renunciation, I don't think it's I think it's sort of a no-brainer, you know. What it means is just what we talked about. If you think carefully for about 5 minutes, and it takes, you have to practice it over and over again, but if you think very carefully right now, at this moment, and think of any good thing in your life, anything, you know, like you're still rather healthy, or you have some good friends, or you have a lama, or you're studying Bodhicaryatara, or anything good about you, your hair, your face, your children, your husband, your house, your job, anything about you, you must lose, period. You know, you must lose it. Something will tear it away from you. There are certain forces at work that will tear it away from you. You must lose it. And it's just a fact of, I think reaching Soglam is just a state where you start to be honest with yourself and see that. You know, it's in front of you all day, but nobody really understands it. Nobody really internalizes it. It's very difficult. Sooner or later, everything you have, down to your face and your name, and then the memory of your name in other people's minds, will be totally wiped out, totally erased. No one will remember you. No one will remember your name. All the pictures of you will rot. Your body will rot, turn to dust. You know, I was in Arizona last year on a retreat, and two deer got hit by a car next to the house. And I watched them rot for about a month, you know. I went back last month to see what was left, and there's just a few small bones left. It was really weird. It was really weird, eerie, that these two huge deer there was just a few bones sticking out of the ground, and their hide had shrunk down to like this much, a little patch, and you couldn't really tell what it was. And that's in 1 year, you know, 6 months. So like 1 year after you die, there won't be even any trace of you. And that's your condition. That's our condition. Anything nice you have, you're going to lose. It will be torn away from you. I mean, you can sort of kid yourself and ride it for a while, but when you start to get around 43, you have to admit it. I mean, you start to see it. And it's just the truth. It's the truth. You can't get anywhere in Buddhism until you admit that. Okay, you just have to admit it. It's actually, somebody I saw interviewed the Dalai Lama and said, oh, Buddhism's very depressing, you know. You're always talking about this fact that you're going to lose everything. And the Dalai Lama laughed in his, you know, his big giggle, you know. And he said, it's liberating. You know, you quit lying to yourself. You know, this is the way it is. And this is the way it's going to be. And just admit it. And I don't think it takes a genius. And that's all. You just have to think like that. It doesn't take a genius. It's going to happen. It will happen. It's happening as we speak. When you get that, you get Soglam. Okay? When you get that understanding, you get Soglam. In general, I'm not going to go into certain specifics of it. Okay? Say, Jolam. Jolam. Jolam means prepare and Lam means path. So Jolam means path of preparation. Okay? Jolam is marked by four stages, and in those four stages, you begin to understand the subject of emptiness more clearly, intellectually. Okay? Intellectually, you start to understand the idea called emptiness. And we're going to talk a lot about emptiness. So don't worry, okay? It's a little bit of a confusing subject. But anyway, Jolam is marked by four stages, and in each stage, you begin to understand more and more about emptiness in an intellectual way in your mind. Okay? And that's Jolam. It's preparing to Tonglam. Say Tonglam. Tonglam. Okay, Tong means to see, Lam means path, so Tonglam means the path of seeing. What you see at Tonglam in the first instant of Tonglam is emptiness, directly, okay, in a deep state of meditation. Not as an intellectual understanding, but purely as a direct and unconceptual seeing of emptiness with your mind. Okay, not with your eyes, okay, but you just, you, for the first time, you see emptiness in a direct way. You perceive emptiness directly without thinking, okay? You're not thinking like, oh, maybe it's empty because of that or because of that or because of that. It's a pure, unadulterated, non-thinking, non-conceptual perception of emptiness. It lasts about 15, 20 minutes, first time, okay? And then there's a second part of the path of seeing where you begin to, you come out of that meditation, you come out of that perception, and you begin to see other things, okay? And the other things you see are some extraordinary, amazing things. And we'll talk about, that's kind of what we're going to talk about tonight. So there's two stages to Tonglam. In the first one, you see emptiness directly, no thinking, no, you can't even say to yourself, I'm seeing emptiness, because all you're doing is seeing emptiness, and you can't have a conceptual thought at that moment. You don't even, you can't even say to yourself, I saw emptiness until the moment that you come out, which is like 20 minutes later, okay, after the direct perception of emptiness. That's Tonglam. Say Gomlam. Gomlam. Gomlam means path of habituation. Gom is also the word in Tibetan that means to meditate. But meditate is called Gom in Tibetan because when you meditate, you're getting your mind used to the object. And the more you meditate on an object, the more your mind will get used to it and the easier it will come up in your mind. So the Tibetan word for meditation is Gom. And in this fourth path, it means to habituate yourself to something. What are you habituating yourself to? You're getting used to what you saw during the second half, especially the second half, but also the first half of the path of seeing. You're getting used to what you saw in the path of seeing. You are applying the understandings that you got from the path of seeing in order to reach special goals. Okay? And that's what Gomlam is. And it's a long process. It's no 20-minute thing. Very typical is 7 lifetimes after seeing emptiness directly. Okay, very typical is for 7 lifetimes you are using the knowledge you gained when you saw emptiness directly and right after that to you're getting used to that knowledge, you're applying that knowledge in your everyday life, and then as a result of getting used to it or practicing, you're able to reach the fifth path. Okay. Say miloblam. Miloblam. Lam means path. Milob means no more study. Okay. We're hoping to reach this. Path of no more learning. This path is a result. I mean, this is the final result. If you're in a certain state of mind called bodhicitta, if you have the wish for enlightenment in your mind at that time, you reach total Buddhahood. Okay? So, if you have bodhicitta equals total enlightenment. If not, it's nirvana. I'll just go over briefly the difference between total enlightenment and nirvana. Okay? And Thubten Phunzo, without any warning, is going to give us the definition of nirvana. Nyangdege senesho. Nyundu. Yimbata. Okay, nice. He beat me. Say Nyundu. Malupa. Bangbe. Sosor. Tango. Nyundip, Malupa, Pambe, Sosor, Tango. Definition of nirvana. Okay. Nyundip means bad thoughts. Okay? Bad thoughts. Malupa means in their entirety. Pangba means to eliminate them in their entirety. Completely. But the real catch is Sosor Tango. Okay? Say Sosor Tango. Sosor, tango. Sosor means one by one. Tak means to realize. Gok means to stop. Okay? And what it means is the stopping of your bad thoughts depends on realizing one by one. Okay? The stopping of your bad thoughts in what we call nirvana depends on realizing something one by one. Okay. What's the one by one? Who's in the mood? Margie? Soso Sho. No? Elizabeth? Soso Sho. Denbashi. Okay. Four Arya truths, sometimes mistranslated as noble truths. Okay? The four Arya truths. Noble is a mistranslation of Arya. And it doesn't mean noble at all. Arya is a word that's used in Buddhist philosophy to mean someone who has seen emptiness directly. Anyone who has reached path number 3 is an Arya. Okay? Anyone who has seen emptiness directly is an Arya. And I said, remember, there was two parts to the direct perception of emptiness. I mean, to Tonglam, to the path of seeing. In the first part, 20 minutes long, say, although you're not aware of the passage of time because that's a relative object, you see emptiness directly. Immediately subsequent to that, for about 24 hours, let's say if you saw emptiness in the morning, say around 10 o'clock, in July of 1975 or something, for the rest of that day, you have these extraordinary understandings come to you. And those can all be grouped into something called the four Arya truths. Okay, they're truths because they're facts. They're reality. And they are seen by a person who's just seen emptiness directly. So they can only be understood directly, in a direct sense, by someone who has seen emptiness directly. And those are called the four Arya truths, sometimes mistranslated as four noble truths. That's the sosor in the definition of nirvana. What you see one by one, in order to stop your bad thoughts permanently, and in their entirety, is those four facts. And it's not just four. I mean, there's many aspects going on during that day. You see many, you understand many, many things. In that one day, you understand the contents of the entire Buddhist books. You know, we would estimate it at around 300,000 Buddhist books. Okay? In that one day, you understand their contents. Period. You know, you understand them absolutely, perfectly, in one day. And that's sosor. Sosor to. You see the Four Noble Truths and all the incredible details related to those four Arya truths one by one. And because of that, once you get used to that, on the fourth path, you can reach a state called Nirvana. And so, to reach Nirvana, do you have to change your outward appearance? No, because it's only stopping your bad thoughts. Okay, you would start acting differently, probably. You know, you might not grimace so much walking through New York City, but outwardly you wouldn't have to change. Okay, you can reach Nirvana tonight. Maybe you reached it last night. We don't know. Maybe you're pretending to go like that. Okay, but it's a mental thing. Okay, if you are able to review what you saw when you saw emptiness directly and get used to it in a very sweet way, with bodhicitta, with the wish for enlightenment, then, at that moment, you don't achieve nirvana, you achieve total enlightenment. What's the difference between total enlightenment and nirvana? At nirvana, you just are getting rid of your bad thoughts permanently. When you reach total enlightenment, there's a whole transformation of your body and mind. Okay? Your body totally transforms. Actually, your mind goes first by about a millisecond. Okay? There's a whole chart. Your mind changes into a totally enlightened mind. You are able to see every object in the universe that ever existed, ever will exist, or does exist now in one instant. In any given instant of your life, you can perceive everything that ever existed, ever will exist, or does exist in the entire universe. That's the state of your mind. Your mind has an emptiness, which is a total, it's difficult to describe, but it's like some total peace. I mean, it's a total, it's the emptiness which is connected to the mind which knows every, Mr. Know-It-All. Okay? And every object in the world has its own emptiness. But the emptiness which is connected to the mind that knows everything is a very special emptiness. And in fact, when you see emptiness directly for the first time, you are seeing the emptiness of a Buddha's mind. And that's called the Dharmakaya. Okay? That's called Dharmakaya. You're seeing that directly. Okay? So, when you become a Buddha, you get a very special state of mind. You know everything. And there's hanging off of it an emptiness. Okay? And we'll talk about that. But that mind has some kind of emptiness. That emptiness is a very, very special emptiness. And we'll get into that sometime. The next millisecond, due to your new state of mind, you're able to show bodies on every planet in the universe simultaneously, if anyone's ready to see them. Okay? You could be showing yourself as Dr. Sykes, sitting here in New York City, if it helps somebody. Okay? If they're ready to see it, and if it helps somebody, you just show up there, automatically. And it's not just in one city or one planet, in every planet in the universe, you are emanating. You are showing up there automatically without any premeditation. You're just there in the next millisecond. And that's called the Nirmanakaya. So that's what the path of no more learning is. If you have in your mind at the moment that you achieve Nirvana or just after that, bodhicitta. Okay. So bodhicitta seems to be rather important. And let's go into it. Okay. I'm going to give you... You know, in Buddhism, we like to give definitions. Who's going to... I think Margie's the expert on this. No? You ready? Yes? No? Who else? You ready? Samgye Gacchen. So, Techen Samgye Gacchen. What's the definition of bodhicitta? By Maitreya. Chanjub de. Yimba ta. De. All right. We'll spell it. This is the definition given by Maitreya. Maitreya is an expert in bodhicitta because he's a Buddha. There's a big debate about whether he's a Buddha already or not, and you can learn it one day. But the bottom line is that he is, in a special sense. Okay. And this is the definition he gives in the Abhisamala Ankara. It's good to memorize it. It's not a big deal. Kids in the monastery memorize this whole book at age 12. Okay. It's just two lines. Say, Yangdat. You guys are sleepy or what? Yanda? Zope? Changchu? The. I'm sorry, did I miss the first one? Semke? Pani? Shendunchu? Yanda? Zope? Changchu? The. The long definition is Rangi Mikba Sunjin Tajila Mikshi Rangi Dro Dzogchan Junya Kidumbada Nanjitu Kepe Techen Namgi Juku Number Kepa Chen. Something like that. Anyway, this is a short one. Semgyepani means bodhicitta, okay? The wish for enlightenment. Semgyepani. The wish for enlightenment. Ni means is. Okay, ni means is. Shenden Chir means for the sake of all other beings. Okay? For the sake of all other beings. Yang Dag Zope Chang Chu means total enlightenment. Okay? Yang Dag Zope Chang Chu means total enlightenment. Du means want to reach. Okay? You want to reach it. Okay? So the definition of bodhicitta, the definition of the wish for enlightenment is the desire to reach total enlightenment for the sake of all other beings. Okay? I want to describe what it feels like. And okay, it's extremely difficult to reach real bodhicitta. If you did it in this life, it would be a tremendous achievement. It's extremely difficult. Okay? Maybe one person in a million gets it in this life. Okay, extremely difficult. You all have to do it, so there'll be 80 million others who won't. So. And I want to describe what it's like at the path of seeing. Okay, so we went to path number 3. We're describing not general bodhicitta. We're describing the bodhicitta that you feel just after you see what? Emptiness directly. Okay, this is a very special instance of bodhicitta. Okay, and to know that you have to see this. Yep. First one. Make sure the second syllable's right. Okay. Say nyamshat. Yeshe. Nyamshat. Yeshe. Nyamshat means deep meditation, an extremely deep state of meditation. To see emptiness directly, you must be at a certain stage of meditation called Samden Dambo Nyodo Mi Chok Me. Okay? You must be there. You have to get there. You can't see emptiness directly if you're not on that platform. Okay? And to reach that platform is very difficult. It's totally impossible to see emptiness on any lower platform than that. You must reach that level of meditation to see emptiness directly. You must be practicing 1 to 2 hours a day meditation every day in order to reach that platform. If you want to disqualify yourself permanently from seeing emptiness directly, don't meditate 1 or 2 hours a day. Because you cannot. You never will. Impossible. Totally impossible. Okay? You must reach that level of meditation to have the mind in the clear state it has to be in to see emptiness directly. Must be. According to every Buddhist school. Okay? Nyamsha Yeshi. Nyamsha Yeshi is the first 20 minutes or so of the path of seeing. That's that direct, pure, total, non-conceptual perception of emptiness. Okay? And all you can see at that moment is emptiness. You can't be aware of anything else. You can't be aware of even yourself seeing emptiness. Because that's not emptiness. Okay? You can't say, oh, I finally did it. You don't have that thought at that moment. You are totally unaware of the passage of time. It could have been a million years. It could have been 2 minutes. You don't know. Because the perception of time is not emptiness. Time is a positive object. Emptiness is a negative object. You cannot be aware of the passage of time. You are in the total, direct, and singular perception of emptiness. And that's all you can be aware of at that moment. Say 20 minutes later, you start to come out. And I think the first feeling or perception that you have is some kind of feeling, a sense of descending. Okay, Because your mind is actually coming back to the desire realm. Your mind, when you perceive emptiness directly, is in a different realm, temporarily. Okay, it's on a completely different level. And you have this sense of coming down. That's not coming down from seeing emptiness, it's coming down from the platform that you had to be on to see emptiness directly. But you have this physical sensation of coming down. Then you get this very joyful thought, I did it. I saw emptiness directly. Okay, it just hits you. Okay, and you remember what you just saw. Then you're conceptualizing again. Okay, you're not seeing emptiness directly. You're seeing it as a mental picture. But you remember what you saw, and you are aware that that was the Dharmakaya of a Buddha. You're aware that you have seen one part of a Buddha's being. And then you, in the next moment, you're thinking, great, Buddhas really exist. You know, because up to that moment, you don't know. Okay, up to that very moment, you have never seen a Buddha directly. Okay, even if you could see, go to India 2,500 years ago, meet this guy walking around with a big bump on his head, you would not have confirmed the existence of a Buddha. But with this experience, you are confirming the existence of a Buddha. You are aware that Buddhas exist. Yeah. No. There can't be any sorwa. There can't be any perception or awareness of your feelings, because that's not emptiness. All you see is emptiness. You cannot be aware of any other object. Impossible. Unless you're a Buddha. Okay. So you're not aware of any other object. You're seeing emptiness directly. And when you come down, you start to... Then you think, Buddhism is true. You know, of all the paths that exist in the world, Buddhism is true. Okay. You have this very strong emotion that Buddhism is the way. And I'm not being sectarian, okay? You actually confirm it by seeing emptiness directly. You also have a perception of your future lives. You see your future lives. You know exactly how many lives it will take you to reach Buddhahood. And 7 is very typical. So I think that is also the first instant typical that you really perceive your future lives. And it's very typical that you have 7 more to go. But you know. And you're aware that in the 7th life, you will achieve Buddhahood. And they won't call you Mike anymore. And that's a very important realization. And you have to cook that one. You have to think about that one. You know, they will not call you Andy anymore. It'll be something different. And that's an important thing. Okay. You get a very important side perception that what you saw was true. That you're not crazy. And that's very important. You get what we call a pramana or a sema. You perceive that what you perceived was correct. You're aware, totally, purely, perfectly, that what you saw was for real. Like there's a second perception that comes during that time after seeing emptiness directly, which confirms the perception of emptiness. So you're never going to doubt it again. The feeling of doubt, the emotion of doubt, is one of the few mental afflictions that you can never have after the path of seeing. On the path of seeing, when you see emptiness directly, you are no longer capable of doubt. No one could ever talk you out of the Buddhist path, because you saw it. Saw Buddha, saw your future lives, saw your future enlightenment perfectly, and you know you're not crazy. There's a second perception that confirms the first perception. And so you have this total elimination of doubt is one of the emotions that you can no longer have. Doubt about the Buddhist path cannot occur after the path of seeing. It's one of the few tongfangs. It's one of the few mental afflictions which is totally destroyed at the path of seeing. Why are we talking about the path of seeing? If you are on a Mahayana track, okay, meaning if you've had some familiarity with bodhicitta already, if you've already developed it to some extent, when you see emptiness directly, in the aftermath, okay, number 2, during that 24 hours subsequent to the... And it's a very amazing 24 hours. I mean, it's just 24 hours filled with incredible things. You can read other people's minds very clearly for the first time, and things like that. It's a very extraordinary day. But if you're on the Mahayana track, then at that moment, in Jeto Pieshe, you get the experience of bodhicitta. You have, I don't want to use a dirty word, but it's like an orgasm. Okay? It's like an experience, an extraordinary experience that lasts maybe a minute or 2 minutes of bodhicitta. And there's some kind of, you get almost a physical sensation of a stream coming out of your heart. Okay, like you can't see anything. I'm not saying like white lights rebounding off the walls. I'm saying there's like this emotion or this feeling of a clear stream of like crystal coming out of your heart and just reaching out to every living being. And you have that direct experience of bodhicitta at that moment. And you know that for the rest of your life, you will spend your life for that, for other people. Okay? And that's bodhicitta. You know, at that moment, you know that you will spend your life that way. The rest of your seven lives that way. And every moment after that. And you see it directly. And then after that, your whole being is aimed at helping other people. You know, your whole activity, everything you do, every experience you have, every money you get, every relationship you form, it has only one point, and that's to help other people. And it's extraordinary. It's extraordinarily sweet. I'm supposed to get up here and talk about the benefits of bodhicitta tonight, okay? And there's this long list, which I'm not even going to do. Okay, you can read it from the reading, and you have to fill in your homework, okay? But that emotion, what happens at that moment, to know that the rest of your lifetimes, and you see some details of your future lives, you know that you will never want again. You know, you will never need anything really. In those seven lives, you will be taking care of Dharma teachers. You will have everything you need. You'll have great parents. You'll have perfect schooling. You'll live in the parts of the world that have Dharma. And it's like a big cradle. You see that that's going to be your future. And there's this emotion of knowing that you will spend every moment after that helping other people. And it is like the ultimate feeling you can have, to be aware that you are just going to live for other people after that. And it's some kind of great release. It's some kind of great release, to be released from the opposite of that, which is watching out for yourself. Okay, there's some kind of extraordinary release or relief from the attitude of watching out for yourself, of just taking care of yourself. You know, if any kind of selfishness is destroyed at that moment. And it's some kind of very blissful release that you know from that moment on you won't be a prisoner of that attitude anymore. And it's worth all the things you ever did in your life to have 1 minute or 2 minutes of that feeling. Because in your heart, you know that even if you haven't had that experience, you know that it's, you know, you can get an inkling or an intuition of what it would be like to stop being selfish completely. You know, if you never had another selfish thought in your mind, you can imagine. I mean, the human soul, the human heart craves and wants this emotion. You know, we all do. And we all get frustrated because we can't have it. You know, until that moment that you get bodhicitta, you can't have it. And everything you do is sort of infected by some kind of selfishness. But at that moment, you get some kind of liberation from that. And it's sweet. And it's some kind of... your heart has been seeking it your whole life. And every time you did something right, like you saw somebody in the hospital, or you helped somebody, or you gave money to somebody, or you kept your patience or something like that, you know, you got a taste of the sweetness of it. But now, at this moment, you know that you will spend the rest of your existence that way. And you will spend the rest of your existence taking care of other people. And it's just an extraordinary experience. It's that experience which has many fallout effects. You know, any kind of powerful bad deeds you've ever collected to go to a lower realm, you just don't have anymore. They're destroyed. They're destroyed by this emotion. Okay, so if all you ever wanted to do was not go to hell or something like that, this is the solution. You know, you won't. It's impossible after that. And you know it. And that's some kind of very comfortable thing. You know, it's like this feeling that, for the, you know, anyone can say anything to me, anyone can do anything to me, it doesn't matter. I know what my next seven lives will be. I'm over. It's over. You know, I'm on my way out. That's why it's called stream enter. You know, I'm on my way out and I know it. And it's some kind of release. And then you feel this urge to show other people that path. You know, you feel this intense urge to show other people that and to protect the books. Because at that moment you see that all the Buddhist books are correct. It's a very weird feeling. You know, 300,000 books, you know, 3 million pages or whatever, they're all totally correct. They are a guide map to enlightenment, and you know it. And so those teachings and those books become some kind of obsession, that you must protect them in the world. And these are all the emotions that you're having when you feel that bodhicitta. So I just wanted to try to convey the emotion of it, or the feeling of it, that you overcome selfishness. If only for that, you know, powerful experience of that few minutes at that particular stage. It's something extraordinary. It destroys all the negative karmas in your being, period. You know, you cannot go down again. And you know it. And that's some kind of amazing feeling. You know, that's some kind of extraordinary feeling. And to be aware that you will become a Buddha, you know, to be aware that you will become a being who can sit there and show bodies on every planet in the universe and help people, and that you will do that, is some kind of extraordinary feeling. It's some kind of, it is the highest form of bliss to know that you'll be able to do that. And that occurs at that moment. So at one moment you're aware that what happened to you is going to destroy every negative thing in you. And you're also aware that what happened to you is going to allow you to become this being who is just this big apple who's feeding everyone in the universe. You know, if someone needs a friend, and if they have the right karma, the Buddha is appearing there as their friend. And trillions and trillions and trillions of friends. And then to know that you're going to be like that is very cool. You know, to know that you're going to be that kind of a being instead of this grubby little selfish guy, you know, is very extraordinary. Nothing like it. So those are the roughly. Now, we'll take a break. And then we'll do the list of the benefits. Yeah, you have a question? Yeah. Yeah. When you become a Buddha, the day you become a Buddha. Other people. Okay. People can perceive that Buddha. Okay. It's very important. There's something very important about the process of naming and how it stops at that moment. So that, yeah. Yeah. Long story. He wanted to know why it's so important that one of the perceptions that you have as you see the Four Noble Truths, after the direct perception of emptiness, is that the day I become a Buddha, they won't call me Mike anymore or whatever. Why is that so important? Partly because anyone who sees your Dharmakaya will no longer, at that moment, be conceptualizing. And they'll be seeing it. If someone sees you, if someone sees your emptiness, your Buddha emptiness, they will be perceiving. They will not be naming or labeling at that point. It's a state in which the only perception is the absence of anything else than labeling. You asked for it, okay? Okay, take a break and come back in 10 minutes, okay? Oh, great. Is that extra? All right. We have like half an hour. Two kinds of bodhicitta, okay? Two kinds of the wish for enlightenment. When you first get real bodhicitta, which is very difficult. Munsam means that feeling that you had at that moment of I'm going to devote the rest of my lives, because, by the way, that's the only, I mean, you're not really sure there's future lives directly. At that moment you are. At that moment you know there's going to be future lives. And you, Munsam is that emotion that I described. It's that understanding, that very clear knowledge that you will spend the rest of your existences helping, dedicated to other people, devoted to other people's benefit. And that's munsam. Okay. In the scriptures, it's called like the desire to take a trip, like planning to take a trip. It's sitting in your house. Here, it's like sitting in exactly the same spot where you saw emptiness directly. I mean, it happens to occur before you get up. Okay, there's actually a third part of the path of seeing when you get up and start walking around. That's another part. But this occurs even while you are still seated on that holy ground, on that place that becomes holy ground, where you saw emptiness directly for the first time. And that's that emotion. That's called munsam. So that's sort of the wish for enlightenment in the sense of wanting to do it and knowing that you're going to do it. Juksem, say juksem. Juksem. Juksem is the day-to-day bodhicitta that gets you through all your days after that, seven lifetimes of days, working for other people. That's the state of mind you're in when you're actually working for other people. And that's less conscious. Okay? It's sort of a undercurrent of your entire day that you are constantly looking. Your day consists of watching out for opportunities to help other people, naturally. You know, you're just naturally attracted to doing from the lousiest little kindnesses to other people up to teaching them how to do it, which is the greatest kindness you can do for other people. And all through your day, you are just skipping from one event to another. You're thinking, you know, what can I do at this moment that would be the most help to people? If you read the biography of Master Shantideva, this is like how he spent his day, right? He's always stopping and using his clairvoyance, you know. Does somebody in Kansas need me right now? And that comes in his biography. So this is the state of mind through which you are spending your days after that moment, okay? That you are actually watching out. You're just naturally spending your entire life and you're prioritizing. You know, if you have a choice between two good deeds, you are naturally attracted to the more important one, which ultimately is reaching Buddhahood yourself and helping other people get there. Okay, so that's the state of mind that you're in, and that's driving your whole life. For the rest of your life, you're going to do that. For the rest of the life, the day will be spent getting up and just looking around and seeing, like Master Shantideva, you know, what's the best thing I can do for people right today? And you start doing it. And that's called juksem. Okay. Technically speaking, you can have, there's a ceremony by which you can commit yourself to munsam, where you can say, "I commit myself to the idea of being a bodhisattva." Okay. Is that bodhicitta? No. I mean, if it was, it'd be easy. Okay. If it was, it'd be really easy. That's not real bodhicitta. But obviously, it's a seed for real bodhicitta. And if you keep doing that, then you'll be able to get real bodhicitta. So there's a ceremony by which you commit yourself to the idea of committing yourself to helping other people. And we're going to do that ceremony in the last class here. It's a very sweet, it plants a seed in your mental stream that will one day become that perception that I described. Okay? And that's munsam. Then juksem is that there's also commitments you can make that are related to juksem. And those consist of the bodhisattva vows. Okay, there's a ceremony by which you commit to the activities of a bodhisattva. And that's like 64 different commitments that you make in a ceremony. And the flavor is very cool. First of Dr. Shenmu, which is not to praise yourself and put down other people. Dr. Shenmu, what's the next one? Chunomiteshi, yeah. You know, you never fail to give other people whatever they need physically or whatever they need spiritually. You commit yourself to that. And that's the flavor of the bodhisattva vows. And then you commit yourself to six kinds of activities called the perfections. So in the second part of bodhicitta, you're committing yourself to doing specific things. In the first part, you're committing yourself to the ideal or the concept of spending the rest of your life helping other people. And those are the two divisions which are on the homework. There's another two divisions that I'm not going to do because people always mix them up. Okay, maybe we'll do it next week. Okay, it's mentioned in your reading and you'll see it. Let me see if it... I'm going to go over two other points on your homework. This class is supposed to get you excited about getting bodhicitta. I mean, I think you sensed it from the other first part, what it would be like. And that's the main, that's all I have to say about it, okay? There's another thing that happens if you're able to reach that state. If you're able to reach the state of that experience called bodhicitta, real bodhicitta, of getting it, there's a certain effect on your mind stream, and I want to talk about that. Okay, we talked in the first class about suffering, and we talked about how there's certain forces at work which destroy your life. Okay, and they're not evident. They're not very obvious. There are certain forces at work which rip out every nice thing that ever happens to you. If you finally meet the man of your dreams or the woman of your dreams and you spend a few years together, and then these forces will kill one of you or both of you at the same time or something, but they will separate you. Inevitably. It always happens. Okay? These forces will separate you from this person you found. These are the forces that make you get old. Okay, and if you don't feel it yet, you will. Okay, and it's no fun, I guarantee you. Russians say, starost ne radost. What does it mean? Getting old is no fun. it's very bad. And it's some kind of cause that's making it happen. There's some kind of forces at work. When you're born, they are created along with your body, and they are destroying your body as you live. You know, they are tearing your body down as you go through life, and then sooner or later they destroy your body. If you don't get hit by a car or cut up by some stupid surgeon, your body will kill itself. You know, the organs are the organs of the body, according to Tibetan medicine, have contradictory functions. They are working towards different goals. The lungs are trying to cool your body down. The stomach is trying to heat your body up. And sooner or later, one of them has to leave town. Okay? There are two functions in contradiction to each other, and one of them will overwhelm the other. If you live long enough, your organs that exist inside the skin will kill each other. One of them will kill the others. If the lungs get, if the power of that, of cooling gets too strong, you get pneumonia, and you die from that. If the power of heating of the stomach gets too strong, you get fevers and you die from that. And Tibetan medicine divides it into broad areas of, it's just a question of which one wins out. But if you don't get hit by a car or cut up by some stupid surgeon, then your body will nicely kill itself. One of the organs will overwhelm the other organs and it'll kill you. Your body will kill itself. And that's the condition we're in. There's some kind of forces running that. There are certain forces dictating that. There are certain energies in the world which are making that happen. And they exist when you are born. And they start working on you, and then sooner or later they kill you. And every kind of good thing you can get, they are at work to destroy it, and they do. If you don't practice Dharma, okay, they will destroy it. These forces are karmic imprints, okay, in your own mind. They are the effects of karmic imprints. Okay, what is a karmic imprint? All right, when you do something nice or something bad, when you say something nice or something bad that hurts another person or helps another person, or even if you think something good or bad for a millisecond, it puts an impression on your mind stream. It puts a very distinct impression on the mind stream. That stays there. And we have a course on karma. You can study it. There's a special presentation on how the imprint stays in your mind, how it's created, and how it is replicated until it gives its result. But basically, every time you have a thought, and in the space of a finger snap, you have 64 discrete karmas of the mind. Leni Sambo, for chapter, Abhidhammakosha, opening lines. Karma is thought. Karma is the movement of the mind. The mind moves at the rate of 64 mental actions per finger snap. You are creating 64 separate imprints in your mind every time there's a finger snap. And each one of those will have its own result. Okay? Right now, in your mind, those imprints are ripening into the perception of this place and me and you. Okay? You see me standing here and you hear me because some kind of imprint in your mind is giving it's flowering and it's creating a perception in your mind. And you see me and you hear me at the rate of there are 64 discrete karmic results going off in your mind in the time it takes to watch me or hear me snap my fingers. There are 64 perceptual events happening. And Madhyamika says it's like they put flower petals on a target, on an arrow target, and they glue flower petals out like 2 or 3 inches. And then a strong man, it says, a very strong man pulls the bow back and shoots the arrow. And when the arrow hits the flower petals, it looks like it does it in one smooth flow. It looks like all the flower petals are being penetrated at the same instant. But logically, you understand what's really happening, right? I mean, you can't see it with your eye. You can see it with microphotography or whatever. But you can see that, but you understand that the first flower petal is being penetrated before the second flower petal, is being penetrated before the third flower petal. And even though it's one thwack, and you just see the arrow penetrated all the flower petals, you know, mentally, you understand that it must have gone through them one by one. Your perception of this world is the same thing. There are discrete, it's like a motion picture. And there are discrete scenes going off, imprints giving their result, and you have the impression of time passing. You know, they're going off so fast and at such a smooth rate that you have the impression of time passing and of events happening in your life. And everybody in this room, according to Buddhism, which you don't have to accept now, but you can prove it eventually in this class, was together in the past at some point. We did some extraordinary virtue in the past. And because of that, we are all empowered to have the same general perception right now. We are all perceiving the Quaker house at this moment. We all have the karmic imprints in our minds that force us to see the Quaker house at this moment. And force is a very important word. Okay? It's forced on you. You don't have a choice. You can't say, I'd rather not see the Quaker house right now. You know, you might say you'd rather not see me right now. And I want to emphasize that it's not willpower. You cannot choose. These perceptions are forced on you. And when you're getting cut up by the doctor, or when the car hits you, or when you have a headache or a cold or something like that, you're very aware of that. You're very sensitive to that point. That by willpower alone, by wanting it alone, you cannot change that condition. Those perceptions are being forced on you by events going off in your mind at the rate of a certain number per second. And it looks like life. It's called your life. It also applies to your thoughts. Okay, your thoughts are the same thing. Thoughts are going off in your mind. You are perceiving your own thoughts. You are thinking your own thoughts. You're also thinking the thinker of the thoughts because they are going off in a smooth flow in your mind due to karmic imprints, due to what you did in the past. And they are being triggered at a certain rate. The laws of this process are very, very cool. And it takes a long time to study it. You have to study the laws of this process. And then you can really catch it happening. You can see it happening. But the bottom line is, you and I have to learn how to plant good imprints. You know, knowing that your life is a series of imprints going off in your mind, it would be prudent to take out all the bad imprints, if you could. And fill up your mind with good imprints. Okay, if you filled up your mind with a lousy little good imprint, you would have a lousy little good experience, like, you know, a good cup of tea or something, and it would last about 3 or 4 minutes or something like that. Okay, if there's a certain kind of minor imprint in your mind from thinking about offering somebody some hot tea on a cold night or something and never doing it, just thinking about it, that creates an imprint in your mind which flowers in the mind as the perception of a cup of tea. So Starbucks exists for you if you enjoy it because of your good karma. Because you were either thinking about, or you were promoting, or you were actually engaged in the activity of giving people something nice to drink. Period. You know, and every detail of your life is like that. Every single detail. So once you know that, and you can prove that, and you can study that, and you can start to manipulate it, and that's fun. That's really cool. You know, want to get rich? You can do it. Want to get $1 million? Set up the causes in advance. Somebody give you $1 million. It's very cold and very calculated. You can do it. If that's what you're interested in. Okay. But there's another thing about the imprints. And you can guess. They wear out. Okay. As they flower, the energy which makes them flower is limited. You know, you only thought for a few minutes to give somebody a nice drink. So you only have a 5-minute imprint. And that imprint flowers, you perceive a cup of tea, you feel a cup of tea on your mouth, you feel it go down your throat, and then about 4 minutes later it's over. And that imprint has just disappeared from your mind. Okay? The imprint is impermanent. Yeah, Hector. Partly, yeah, partly. It's called, there are 4 karmic results, and one is the tendency to enjoy doing it from having done it a lot in your past life. Like, you see certain children, we were talking about the other day, you go to their parents' house, and they walk over to you with a cookie, and they want to feed you. There's like these special kids like that. And these are children who have in their past lives been giving a lot, and they don't have that normal child's thought of being possessive. And that the habit or the being attracted to goodness is a result of a past karma. Yeah, it's one of the 4 results of doing good deeds or bad deeds. So we have to try to imagine a karma. Like if you want to set up your future, you know, you can actually choose what you want. You know, you have to study how to plant imprints, and you have to study how to accelerate imprints. And then actually you could conceivably in this very life consciously and purposely plant certain imprints in your own mind and then use special methods called Tantra to accelerate them and then cause them to flower before you die. You know, you can do that. And that is the process. You can study karma, you can understand what imprints are most effective, and then you can study the methods for accelerating their growth, you know, and also the methods for eliminating old bad imprints. And you can do it quite consciously and quite coldly. You know, I mean, quite. You can design your future at any point in your life if you understand Dharma. You can design your future. You will be limited by the attitudes that you spoke about. You know, if you have bad attitudes from bad karma, you'll be limited. For example, if you don't have the capacity of great faith, if you're not capable of feeling extreme devotion because of some bad karmas in your past, then you might not be able to pull off that process in this life, because that is one of the accelerators. You know, that is probably the primary accelerator of a good karma in the higher teachings. So you have to study what are the best imprints to put in your mind. Why am I talking about all this? One of the benefits of bodhicitta, one of the selling points in Master Shantideva's text, and I'm not going to give you all the questions on the homework tonight. You have to study your reading, okay? One of the selling points is that you tell me what kind of imprint would create an entire world of bliss for you in the future. You know, okay, get this. If you give, you're going to get rich. If you keep your morality, you're going to be happy. If you keep your patience, you will have a beautiful body and a beautiful face. And like that. So you tell me, you know, what's the ultimate imprint? If you have to sit here and just arrange imprints tonight, you go home and say, yeah, I don't want to just have a coffee for 5 minutes. I'd like a bliss of an ultimate Buddha paradise for all time. How about that? You know, I mean, you can decide. You can decide What is the imprint which creates that? Partly. Because bodhicitta is interesting. From the point of view of quality of the bodhicitta, and from the point of view of the scope of the bodhicitta, it is perfect karma. It's a perfect imprint. And in fact, at that point, we don't call it karma. We call it collecting the two collections. Okay, the name changes. But you are designing your future paradise with the best way of all to do it. Because the scope of bodhicitta is how big? It's infinite. Okay? Can you help an infinite number of beings right now? No. Do you have to start with the people around you, and particularly the person sitting next to you that maybe is the last person you'd like to start with? Yes. That is all sentient beings for you right now. That's all the sentient beings that you can reach right now. And unfortunately, that's the one you have to work with. Okay? Those are exactly the sentient beings that represent for you all sentient beings. So bodhicitta has to be directed from the beginning at the people around you. And then based on the people with whom you have a direct experience, you imagine or you expand the idea out to all other living beings. Okay. And at the moment that you get real bodhicitta, that emotion is aimed at every living creature in the universe. And you really, I don't know if you can really even imagine it until that moment, what it would feel like to aim it that way. But intellectually, you can do that now. You know, as an exercise in collecting good imprints, which is of great importance for anyone, you can do it right now. Now, that's the scope that would create... By the way, if you leave out one person, what happens? If there's one asshole at work that you just do not want to include, you know, it's not true bodhicitta, but what's the karmic result? By the way, you got to understand what a Buddha paradise is like. Every single detail of every single perception, from seeing the corner of the railing up there, to seeing some guy's windowsill up there on the other side of the street, and hearing some traffic noises outside, and having some subliminal thoughts about what you'd like to eat after you get out of this place, all of them are bliss. Every single perception is total bliss. Imagine the most pleasant moment you've ever had in this life. Imagine the 10 or 20 seconds of extreme pleasure you've had in this life. And then multiply it times everything you perceive. The stripes on Hector's shirt. The details of the design on his tie. Each one gives me that feeling. All the time. Okay, if you leave out one person, one stripe won't. And that's not a Buddha field. Okay, that's not a Buddha paradise. Really. So really, it's the only way to get to a Buddha paradise. What I'm trying to say is this is a selling point for bodhicitta. You cannot, and you will never, reach Buddhahood if you don't have perfect bodhicitta. Impossible. Because the imprint will be defective. The imprint will be $1 short, one day late, you know, and it won't create it. Did you have a question? He asked that what if the exercise of trying to get bodhicitta was infected by the desire to win the lottery or something like that? You know, what if it was infected by the limited desire to win the lottery or something like that? Okay, to rephrase your question, that's okay, right? You'll read in your reading, and you might miss it if you don't look carefully, that one of the selling points for bodhicitta is that it accomplishes all your desires, all your wishes. And those wishes start with lousy, short-term, this life wishes, and trying to stay out of the hells in your next life for your own rear end, all the way up to the desire to bring each person to a perfect paradise like the one we described. But none of them is exclusive. None of them is contradictory. I think that's it's a problem to think like that. They're called shared. Okay. Yeah, no, that's obviously bad. Yeah. But we call in Buddhism shared. And in your first reading, you might have noticed the word adjunct. Okay. Adjunct means, shared, means the highest bodhisattvas in the universe would like to have a nice coffee. they would like to not suffer in their next life. And they would also like to reach a higher birth in the next life. And they would also like to reach Buddhahood for all sentient beings. And those are not contradictory goals. But the lower ones are only shared with people of lower motivation. You know, they're not exclusively that. We are not allowed, you're not allowed anymore as a bodhisattva to limit your vision to coffee or to limit your vision to your own happiness. It's destructive. Yeah, as you said, it's a very bad thing. It's a great danger. But we are encouraged to practice it as an adjunct. You know, Buddha would like to have a nice cup of coffee. Buddha would like to live in a nice apartment, and will. Buddha would like not to go to a lower birth in his next life. Buddha would like to stay in the upper realms if he had to. But on top of that, and always, it's encompassed by a much broader thing. And if you don't have that vision, if your vision is limited, your future will be limited. So what Master Shantideva is pointing out in the verses you'll read is that if all you care about is your own happiness, it's still the smartest thing to do. Okay? It's still the best thing to do, is to work for other people's happiness. Mm-hmm. And you will not be able to reach ultimate, you will never reach any kind of real happiness in this life if you don't care for other people. If you don't work for other people, impossible. It won't happen. You cannot collect the proper imprints. Imprints are always collected relative to other people. Most often. Imprints are always impressed on your mind through your relationships to other people. Almost always. I mean, there are some exceptions. If you scream in a traffic jam, you can put a bad imprint in your mind. If you stub your toe on a rock and you get angry at the rock, you can put a bad imprint. You will put a bad imprint in your mind. But mainly, you cannot do great good or great evil unless there's other people around to whom you're focusing. And that's just the way karma works. The imprints work like that. So the selling point for bodhicitta is that if you want to transform your life, bodhicitta, it says in the text, can take this body, which is doomed. I mean, all of our bodies are doomed. They are defective. You know, they are just time bombs waiting to go off. Your body will destroy itself sooner or later. Probably sooner than later. Probably already started, as you may have noticed. And if you have real bodhicitta, then you can actually transform this body to another body before you die. Okay, you have to get bodhicitta, and then you have to accelerate it, and most preferably with the secret teachings. If you can get instructions in the secret teachings, then that is the process of how to accelerate it so that it's more certain to happen before you die. Okay? And you must have bodhicitta to do that. You must get that or it won't happen. We're talking survival, right? We're talking the choice between dying like a plain old person or moving to another kind of existence before you die. Last question. If I move to my other existence before I die, will you see it? Maria said, "Not necessarily." I would say almost certainly not. I would say almost certainly not until you yourself are at the karmic point where your karma and your own mind are so pure that you're about to enter that state or close to entering that state. You won't see a thing. You know, the Dalai Lama will look like he reached his 61st birthday and he's a little bald and getting wrinkles. You know, but what does the Dalai Lama experience about the Dalai Lama? Okay. What is his experience of his own body and his own mind? If you're not close to that experience yourself, you cannot see it. You'll never see it. There could be, and there certainly are, beings in this room who are enlightened. And you just can't see it because you're not close enough. And you see them as normal people. And that is the great lesson of Master Shantideva's life. You know, Mr. Three Thoughts. Okay. Until you reach that, close to that state, everyone around you will look pretty similar to you. So it's quite possible that people around you have attained some kind of this state, and you wouldn't even, not only you wouldn't see it, but you can't see it, because you're not good enough. It's 9. Somebody had one question, I think. No? Yeah. Oh, okay, they won't go home without it, okay? The rest of the questions on the homework you can figure out from the reading. Okay. Now, last selling point that Mary asked me to to do. There are many, many people in the United States who want to learn these things. And the number of qualified lamas like Ken Rinpoche out in New Jersey is about zero. I mean, I won't say zero, but I'd say you could count them on one hand, you know. I mean, the good lamas, the really, even any kind of lama in the United States, you know, I can't say good or bad, it's not I don't know. But if I were to try to name to you 10 lamas that I know in the United States, I don't think I could do it. I don't think there's more, I'm not aware of more than 10 good, I mean, I shouldn't say good. I'm not aware of more than 10 Tibetan lamas who've had a lot of training who are teaching in the United States. I'm not aware of them. If they exist somewhere, I don't know about it. And there have been hundreds of people who have written to us, and they said, we want to learn these things. And they're very, very devoted, and they really want to know. And for different reasons, they can't come here. Some are a lot of them are in prison. A lot of them are just like family people with a decent job, and they have 5 kids, and they can't move. And then a very small percentage moves here, but it's difficult for them. It's very difficult to move to New York, especially if you're from any other place, which I can tell you, because I came from Arizona, and it was like a disaster when I got here. So there are many people interested in these classes. There are hundreds of people taking these classes by correspondence. And they really, really want to have a personal connection. They want someone to look at what they wrote on their papers, to make a comment, to say something, and it means a lot to them. We get dozens and dozens of letters from people who really say, you know, this saved my life. I had a guy call me from North Carolina. He was crying. He's a doctor. He was crying on the phone. You know, he's just crying for like 5 minutes. And I'm like, okay, you know. and it's like that. I mean, it's very important. So I want to, we need people to help grade them. We don't have enough people, okay. I'd say, what, anyone who's taken 2 courses? If there's any, the people here who have taken at least 2 courses, I'd like, John, can I talk to you? Mary, put your hand up. That's Mary. Mary's like struggling to, she just did her 7,000th audio tape, okay? And she's struggling to keep up with all this stuff. And she's in the dungeon over at Three Jewels, down in the basement with all the dripping water and stuff. And we really need people. And I'm not going to say anything else. If you're sitting here in a bodhisattva class, I don't think I'm not going to say anything else. Okay, we really need people. Talk to Mary, sign up. If you don't, I'll come after you. Okay? Okay? It's not hard, and it's very sweet, and it means a lot to people. You know, especially like prisoners and stuff like that, it means a lot to them. So don't be crazy. You know, you have to do it. We have to do it. Okay? And you find some time and you do it. Okay? That's my sales pitch. If you tell me next week. If not, I'll break some arms. Do you have a question? Excuse me? Okay. And then we'll stop. That's secret teachings, and I won't teach that. Right. Okay. We'll meditate for just 1 or 2 minutes. You know, try to think about try to imagine the day that you perceive emptiness directly, if you have not already. And imagine from the description what it might feel like. Okay, just for 1 or 2 minutes, and then you're actually going home pretty much on time this time. So. Okay, I repeat, there's no class on Tuesday. Okay, it'll be on Thursday.